When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.
Eat.
Jake Gunkelman. The pride of Tucson City.
That's a good one. I get out so little that there's a lot of people in town who have no idea I'm here, even, I'm sure. So they much less.
Yeah, they come to you.
Yeah, well.
I saw the literature. Looks good.
Which literature is this?
Literature I'm putting right here.
So, we've got a number of topics that you sent out today, as usual, kind of a scattergun of different things, not necessarily focused on a specific issue, but that matches up our style here.
That's right.
We'll sail in one direction and then tack off in the other, you know? So,
the wind takes us, Jay. Go ahead.
Wherever the information kind of guides us. So, one of the links that you sent tweaked me a little bit. Ooh. You know, Stanford had a study on ketogenic diet. And they're saying, oh, it's good for psychiatric disorders. Well, if all they did is give ketogenic diet to DSM categories and see if some of them responded, they didn't do the study they could have done looking for what biomarkers ketogenic diet works for. Now, we know in epilepsy, ketogenic diet is one of the tools in the tool belt to stabilize the EEG in epilepsy. So epilepsy is either going to have beta spindles as the trigger point or overt epileptiform content. One or the other of those biomarkers should have been what they were looking for, not a DSM category that doesn't predict anything. So they could have found a more specific biomarker targeting for this therapy to match it with the people that it would work for. It's not going to work for all of those who have bipolar or all of those who are psychotic. Those are the two categories that they kind of focused on. But you have to remember that psychosis has a high incidence of epileptiform content. The study that I showed, and I can pop it up here again. There it is. So when we're looking at epileptiform content in various disorders, ADD, ADHD, and so forth, but if it's epileptiform content, you may be able to assist about a 25-30% of the ADD population as well, but we don't know if it is or not. It might just be beta spindles, in which case it would probably help somewhere in the 10-20% range. In the anxiety disorder with panic, it's 30%. And the panic ends up bringing up the likelihood of discharges. So there's a, up to a third of those who have panic may be helped with the ketogenic diet if the biomarker is epileptiform content. But let's get down to it here. Mood disorders that don't make any sense. A third of the people that have psychiatric disorders that have epileptiform content, a third of the people have epileptiform content. And, you know, these are not small little studies. And in this review, which is 1,200 something patients in general, but these are the different categories that they were in, psychosis of the about 30 patients, about half of them had epileptiform content. So, you know, if they were doing their job, they would have not stuck their head up the butt of the DSM and looked around. That they would look for biomarkers, not DSM categories. Now, you can pull people from those DSM categories because they're classified there, but don't let that be your end goal for your research. Ketogenic diet helps for this behavioral cluster, doesn't guide you for how to prescribe it. If it's a biomarker, now you know when to use it. And it's really unfortunate because it could have been epileptiform content and it could have been beta spindles, both of which are highly likely, but we don't know which or both. And, you know, they had the opportunity because they did the work, but they didn't do the design of their study in a proper way. They're still, as a lot of psychiatry still is, they're still oriented towards the DSM diagnostic categorizations. It's their, they've used it for so long, they're reliant on it. It's how they think. It's clusters they think about. But we know that those clusters don't have any predictive validity. So, and you have to have predictive validity. If what you come up with, category A, B, C, D, whatever the categorization system is, if it doesn't predict outcomes, it's just categorization. It's not, there's no utility to it. And unfortunately, the DSM is just categorization without any predictive validity. And the group that produces it admitted it, but they cling tightly to, you know, the Titanic is going down and they're grabbing onto pieces of it, thinking that it's still okay in some fashion. So well,
the music's still playing. So,
yeah.
So yeah. Jay, on that, when I hear keto, I hear anti-sugar and the brain runs off of glucose.
Oh, that's it. That everybody knows the brain burns on glucose only. let's take a quick look at that.
Yes. Okay.
If your brain burns glucose only and your glucose cycles and glucose does cycle, you're going to have some pretty wild ups and downs in your brain function. And when you're older and your brain start to become insulin resistant, you're going to have a difficult time burning the blood sugar, so your voltage is going to drop. Your brain needs voltage to run. I have seen personally individuals who could not draw a clock. You know, it's a cognitive test, and you basically don't have any instructions other than draw a clock. So, you know, you could do Big Ben if you're really artistic or something, but most people draw a circle. They have some numbers around it, and they have a couple of hands sticking out from the center. Some put a little fob on the top to wind it. You know, I mean, they're different detail, but you expect the basics of a clock. I've seen them where you hand the paper back, and you cannot tell that they tried to draw a clock. It's not integrated enough to know what their intent was. You can see a two-year-old attempt to draw a person with things disjointed in pieces and the smile goes off the face and stuff. You know, that's you know, kind of disintegrated. It's not fully integrated. And these totally disintegrated draw clocks are indicative of cognitive a failure, basically. It's an end stage finding in dementia, is that you cannot draw a clock at all. Well, they were put on not a full ketogenic diet, but a modified ketogenic diet. And, you know, full keto is, you know, the caveman diet, the paleo diet. It's pretty rigorous as to what you can and can't do. There's a modified Atkins diet that does a good job doing ketones. But what we're trying to do is place ketones into your system so your brain has its backup fuel supply. It's like a car that uses electricity or gas, you know, and you've run out of the electricity because your glucose is gone kaput. Either you bottomed out on your dip, or you're not burning it anymore, and you got to flip back over to burning gas. Well, ketones are that. It's your backup fuel supply, and it gives you an additional 40%. Now, doesn't Elon Musk want an extra 40% of the mileage on his car? You know, man, you could buy it and drive to LA without a problem at that point, you know? So 40% more juice is not insignificant. And the gentleman comes back in, sits down, draws a circle, puts the numbers around the outside, has two hands going out, one short, one long, and he has a little winder stem on the top. It's a little pocket watch that he likes. So it went from total disintegration to a quasi-artistic rendition by somebody who's not really an artist, but he did a damn good job. You know, I mean, he didn't have the threads on the stem winder or something, but I mean, he had, it was a well done. This was a success, not a failure on the draw the clock. And he got all the points, you know. So what I would suggest is that it's an important metabolic support. Now, the modified diet that these seniors did was a very easy one to do. You don't have to go to the butcher shop and, you know, buy, you know, some big bone to chew on or something to call yourself a paleo diet. You need to increase the lipids. And one of the tastier ones is coconut oil. And if you make hot cereal in the morning, cream of wheat, grits, whatever, toss a little tablespoon of, maybe two tablespoons of coconut oil on it. You toss a pat of butter on it. It's kind of the same thing.
So and you mean like MCT oil or like that?
You're going to end up having a tasty breakfast, and you're going to end up boosting your metabolic supply during the day. Sugar flares off like gasoline thrown on a fire. Woof, it's gone. Dump a bunch of oil next to a fire. It'll burn and burn and burn and burn and burn and burn and burn. And the ketones are slow, steady, solid fuel. They don't flare off. They sustain. Now, the combo is great. You can have a nice peak and still ride a good baseline. And if you've got a balanced diet and a healthy system, you probably have ketones operating in some fashion already. But seniors who start to eat, well, making dinner for one isn't exactly, you know, exciting. So you might go to a TV dinner or something, which is got like Zippo nutrition in it or something, you know, eat the tray it came on, you have a better diet, you know, at least you got some fiber, you know. But we basically end up having deteriorated metabolic function as we age, and part of that ends up contributing to our decline in mental function. And if your diet is keto-free, you have a higher probability of having cognitive dips as your blood sugar goes up and down. And it will. I mean, the glucose tolerance test is given as a one big shot of glucose. And they track you with periodic blood draws to watch how fast it goes up and how fast it comes down. And if you're somebody who burns off your blood sugar really fast, your blood sugar after a meal is going to tank right after it spikes. And that tanking ends up being a cognitive dip. And you can avoid that again with the 40% additional from the ketones.
Yeah, I know we're not nutritionists here, but we do hear about ADHD quite a bit. How does, on the flip side of things, how does too much sugar in the kids' diets, you know, then you put caffeine on top of it when they go to Starbucks and they get a blast of sugar and caffeine. How does that help?
Well, your body's going to get lazy metabolically if you keep throwing sugar bursts at it. The big problem is you've got epileptiform content in these kids in the ADD population as well. And independent of the epileptiform content, you've also got beta spindles in them. And both of those are hyperexcitable cortex, and they can be kindled up. They need to be stabilized. And again, the possibility of ketogenic diet or boosting the ketone balance in your diet, at least, ends up being something that would potentially help a large number of these. And the autism population is a high probable group. And then obviously there's people that actually just have epilepsy outright. The ketogenic diet has been part of epilepsy treatment for decades and decades and decades. This is not new at all. Not at all. Not recent, not past, it's distant past. So ketogenic diet has been used therapeutically in epilepsy for a long time. So the, you know, more recent, also in the running attempt to use it for other things is well warranted. But I think, again, it was ill-conceived in that they didn't look for biomarkers. You can still pull from clusters of DSM categories, but do some profiling and get your biomarkers. You're going to end up having a much stronger statement that you can make about the ketogenic diet, other than just gross psychiatric categories that might benefit. You'd end up being able to pinpoint who will benefit. And it's unfortunate that they didn't, you know, kind of step up the, you know, Stanford's a major academic institution. You'd think that they'd have higher levels of thought than that. But,
well, they do have that branch of the university that works on manipulating your mind in advertising. We won't touch that. But you've been around...
go buy an EEG machine.
Okay. I don't. As seen on the NeuroNoodle podcast.
People have looked at sales stuff for a long time and ways to manipulate with a little bit of everything, smells. There's actually people that hook up brains and eye movements and electrodermal, and they'll expose them to anything from architectural design to a movie, and track what catches their interest, what catches their eye, and all of that. So there's a lot of biophysical monitoring to actually judge. You might lay out a store one way, and then when they actually test how people come in and they're all looking over there, not over where you think they're going to be looking. And so you got to redo your layout to end up matching people's styles. So
feedback. Jay, do you think the food pyramid screwed this whole thing up?
The food pyramid threw something up.
But I mean, I don't remember, but oh, fat bad, carb good.
The fad, this is good, that's bad, has, I remember when butter was bad and oleo margarine, the white kind that had a little yellow packet that you could stir in, that was the good stuff. Pure hydrogenated, I mean, it's the exact kind of thing that they tell you, oh, no, don't do any of that anymore, So, but, people grab a little tiny piece of knowledge and
Yeah.
assume it explains everything else, and it doesn't. And you've got to be careful of diet fads, guru diet experts. Common sense isn't very common, but it would be good to have some common sense that guided your dietary choices, not just something it pulled off of Google.
Well, I JFK, he got America working out, okay? And I don't know, pick your poison. Everybody was skinny back then. They just didn't work out. I mean, they walked a lot, but JFK got involved and America worked out more. And then something happened in the early 70s. I don't know what it was, that this is what you must eat and fats are bad and all that. And when did corn come? I know we're getting ahead of our skis here, I understand, but this all play we don't have Marie here to say no, so we can do whatever we want, but
High fructose corn syrup,
corn,
never
yeah.
heard of it. Never heard of it. Never heard of it. So,
So we had to take care of the farmers.
there's nothing wrong with corn, but high fructose corn syrup is not really a great dietary addition, and in processed foods they use that as a sugar basically, and you find it in a lot of the sugary drinks as the source of the sugar instead of sucrose, which was the old style sugar that you would find. And there are a lot of people who said, oh, well, the Mexican Coke uses the real sugar,
Yeah.
so that's the sucrose down there, and it's all fructose corn syrup up here. And I don't know that how much of an urban myth that was or what, but I lived in Crockett, California for quite a few years, and CNH sugar is there, and they produce a lot of sugar. They're happy to hear that high fructose corn syrup is having a smaller market share because they'll be happy to fill it with sucrose. They're the largest sugar refinery in the U.S. and they're right on the water, so they're perfectly poised for international shipping. And anyway,
Yeah.
they have a cogeneration power plant that operates the refinery, so they get their heat to refine the sugar, and they produce power for the grid. So
Jay,
I helped the design on that.
what didn't you
They
help the design on?
well, they came into town with, cogeneration's a great idea, but you can have a great idea and put it in a bad spot and do it poorly. And that's what they were doing. They were putting it across the street from Victorian homes that had across the street down a slope, there's water. And they were going to have a 20-foot corrugated metal wall to block their view. And they were going to have steam plumes from the cooling towers that would have blocked the view of the Carquinez Straits for the entire town of Crockett. And that didn't sound like such a good deal. And they tangled with a town that didn't want to be messed with. And a little town can really organize. The California Energy Commission had never had more than one public intervener on a project, somebody who wants to become involved in the process yeah. and make comments and all of that. And we actually put out 100 public interveners who not only applied to be interveners, but also applied for pauper status so that we wouldn't have to make 150 copies of everything we submitted. We would send in one, then they had to copy it and send it out. So I was actually declared a pauper by the state of California. So
I'm working on that in Illinois, but we're all paupers in Illinois.
But we basically in California, the Energy Commission gives them a 1-year statutory guarantee when from the time you submit to the time you get your decision. And they submitted, but then we read their submission. And, you know, this is a big stack of details. I mean, technical engineering details. But one of the things you have to read is the law that they're complying with when they're submitting it. So we didn't just read what they submitted. We read the entire law that authorizes the Energy Commission. They had to submit their document under penalty of perjury, that it was accurate and true to the best of their knowledge under penalty of perjury. There was no such cover letter. We saw everything they submitted. They didn't include the cover letter. So when their time came, we stood up and said, you know, you can't accept their submission today because they didn't submit it under penalty of perjury. And it shall be submitted under, it says right here in your law that you have to comply with that authorizes your commission, it shall be submitted under penalty of perjury. So they had to go back and resubmit it the next time. Meanwhile, in the audience, all the others who had theirs, if they didn't already have a cover letter, were whipping together a cover letter for under penalty of perjury, and their power plants got approved under the need that was projected. And the power plant, the cogen plant, suddenly half of the power that they were going to produce wasn't actually projected to be needed. So they would be a dispatched plant, not a baseload plant. So that changes the modeling, emission modeling. Turning on and off a plant is dirtier than letting it run smoothly. So it changed all of their modeling. Their application just fell apart. I'm sorry. They were a small outfit out of Oklahoma, and their general partnership. And so they, rather than be a failure, they withdrew their submission. They got more partners into the general partnership, and they resubmitted it with a whole bunch of improvements and corrections and things. And one after another, I've fought the various pieces of it. They were going to use anhydrous ammonia, and the tank would be right next to the railroad tracks. And we argued that, well, if a train were to derail and hit that tank and rupture it, the anhydrous ammonia would form a cloud, and if the wind was in one direction, it'd kill about 1,500 people. And they argued, well, the risk management people, the likelihood of a train derailing on the track in this spot across the life of the plant is like a bazillion, quadrillion, bazillion to one, and it's not going to happen, so there's no risk, so we don't have to do it. We actually brought in the guy who did the risk modeling for the space shuttle and was fired when he told him it would blow up one out of 31 times, which is what it did. So, and he said, you know, it could derail on this curve. It's not at all hard to imagine.
In Ohio. So
they buried it, much to their chagrin. They were forced to bury the tank underground and switch from anhydrous to aqueous ammonia, which is not nearly as hazardous. I lived up in the woods for 3 years after the plant was being built, and I came back down. The day I moved back to town, there was a train derailment. The next morning, there was no news of thousands of people being killed, but the wind was in exactly the right direction, and the tank was swept over top of by train cars. It would have burst the valves and pipes and would have released it. So,
Jay, you saved 1,000 lives.
No, the process did.
Okay.
I was the pain in the ass. I was the pain in the ass that they were having to respond to. But you know, that one was withdrawn. It came back a third time. And every time you're going up against somebody, you got to know who your opposition is, really. So you do a Dun & Bradstreet on them. Mm-hmm. And you know Dun & Bradstreet. It gives you a good profile of what a business is like, where their office is, what the office looks like even. I mean, does it look well kept? How many employees? What's the annual income, et cetera? And Pacific Generation was a division of Pacific Corp, a $10 billion profit per year corporation. They took over the general partnership. So I realized we are going up against Goliath, and we're not even David. We don't have a freaking slingshot. There's no pebbles. We are about to get stomped by this new applicant. And he sent an engineer group to town, and they met with me and said, okay, we're going to build this. What would you like to see? You know, where would you like to see it? How would you like us to do this so that we don't end up having the kind of opposition that you've given for the last 8.5 years? So we totally redesigned the plant. Instead of 4 shafts with 2 steam turbines and 2 gas turbines and 4 generators on 4 shafts, it's 1 gigantic shaft. The largest GE Frame 7E turbine, gas turbine, and a steam turbine and a generator on a single shaft. 4 shaft turning, 1 shaft turning, less friction, higher efficiency. It's the highest efficiency power plant that had ever been designed. And we didn't want steam plumes in the view. So they built the world's largest dry cooling system. It's like an air conditioner for the power plant. And it's placed above the power plant. It's a second story above the plant to keep it from being too much in across the street from these nice homes. We placed it behind a bunch of bulk bins in an industrial area. It's the smallest acreage and the highest power production in the world. And, you know, it's 480 megawatts, and it's a gigantic plant, like the size of one that would be seen in Oakland or San Francisco, a gigantic plant. And it's in the core of the Bay Area, so it's utilized quite well. It has selective catalytic reduction for the nitrous oxides. You burn natural gas, and you're going to end up with nitrous oxides going up the stack. So in the stack, you inject ammonia. And just above that, there's a vanadium honeycomb catalyst bed. And all of the nitrous oxide will be broken down into elemental nitrogen as it goes through. So you get rid of almost all of the NOx with the selective catalytic reduction. And the town was concerned about how to control the sound. They didn't want to have a loud plant. And they were interested in having us tell them exactly what technology to use for sound control. What I suggested is we have measurements standing on the road next to your plant as how noisy it is now. Whatever you build has to have that same level. We can't hear it any more than what we hear now. So whatever you have to do to muffle it, whether you have to add another layer of foam over a wall, I mean, baffle something, have noise canceling, like a Bose headset noise cancellation kind of thing. There's those for industrial things too. Whatever you have to do, you know, they agreed to meet the standard as opposed to have us specify the hardware. The final twist, when they started, it took 10 years for this one-year guarantee process to happen finally. But at the end, they got to build their plant. But when they started, they told the town, the public affairs person told the town, you know, it's going to happen within a year. They're going to start to build this thing. And if you're lucky, you get $100,000 to do something in the town. We got $1 million a year for 30 years. For a town of 3,000 people. Now, if you plan and you realize 30 years from now, our income is going to go to Zippo, you have to think ahead, because people are going to become accustomed to spending money like the drunk sailors that they all are, you know? And what we did is we set it up so a third of the money each year goes into an endowment. And you can spend two-thirds of what you want. You know, just buy this, spend that, upgrade this, design that. You know, do a parade, do a fair, you know, help out the Lions Club or the Elks Club or the Women's Club or the Old Homestead or whoever with a little project. Do whatever you want with the other two-thirds of $1 million. But a third of it goes straight to the endowment. And at the end of 30 years, the endowment, drawn down at 5% interest, which you can do, gives you the money that you used to get from direct income. You're just drawing down off the corpus. So we set that up, and it's been operating. It's coming close to the 30-year point. And they're going to continue to spend money just like the drunken sailors that they all are. You know, now, at the time, they studied the town. The Foundation on Foundations, there is such a thing, set up by the Rockefeller Foundation. They studied the foundation because it was an industrial settlement. It wasn't a normal foundation, like some rich guy gives a bunch of money because they were guilty for being so damn rich, and they give some money to somebody and for some purpose, and they set up a foundation. Somebody dies, and in their honor, a foundation is set up. That's the kind of foundation. This is an industrial settlement. The foundation is funded because an industrial plant is going to have an impact, and you're doing an offset for it, and this public benefit offset. So is this a good way to do it? Or is this really a stupid way to do it? The foundation that we set up had an elected board of directors. The lawyers who helped us set it up told us, okay, we'll appoint a set of directors. And when there's a vacancy, the board will appoint another person on the board. We said, no, we're going to make an elected board of directors. If it's an appointed board, the board will end up being a little clique, and they won't be accountable to anybody. They will spend money any way they want and not necessarily the way the town wants it spent. So you're just going to create a gigantic sore. There's going to be some people angry at other people, and it's just not going to work. So every other year, the League of Women Voters comes into town. If you can show you live in town, you don't have to be a registered voter to vote politically. If you live in town, you get to vote for the person who goes onto the board of directors for the foundation. And after 7 years, they basically decided this is the best way they've ever seen to administer industrial settlement funds. You could have taken that $1 million a year and split it between the people in town, and, you know, it would have gone up somebody's nose, and somebody would have bought a fancy car and wrecked it. You know, there would have been a lot of trips, you know, on this here and there, but where would have been the concentrated benefit for the town? Mm-hmm. You know, when the town gets the money and can decide how to spend it, you get cumulative benefit, not scattered, disjointed projects. It's organized and works out well.
Well, Jay,
Anyway,
that
the Foundation on Foundations thought it was a good idea after we were told by the lawyers, "You're crazy." Nobody's ever done it that way. We said, "Well, thank you for your counsel, but that's the way we want it done, you know." And anyway, it turned.
this portion of the NeuroNoodle podcast sponsored by Greenpeace, Jay.
Well, my neuroscience part of me is my vocation, but my environmental's my avocation. It's what I do for fun, and I've actually got a whole world in environmental stuff, including designing laser pollution detection systems for refineries, which were designed 30 years ago. Everybody said, "What are you crazy? Why are you using physics to detect chemistry?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was a good idea with the lasers, you know." Now they're mandated for all the refineries in California, and they're being used in the industries around the world. And the design is in public domain. There's nobody that can own the design.
Jay,
So.
don't tease me. We might have to do an environmental podcast. I would be the biggest hypocrite, but I would do it for you.
Well,
Jay, this.
I was called an EIR hitman by the Sierra Club back in late 80s, early 90s. So.
Jay, the paper that you have on the shared screen here, that's a pretty substantial, important paper. And two things I like to have you do is one, just explain, the authors, Martine Arnes, Ron is on
Sure.
there.
Ron was a customer of mine for a decade, and he de-identified, now it's a couple thousand patients, I think, somewhere in that range, and made them all accessible, an IRB approved access to researchers to the data. Martine Arnes is an old friend in the Netherlands, and he is the director of education for NeuroCare Group, and he's a visiting professor right now at Stanford, looking at TMS and cardiac deceleration associated with the proper location for the TMS coil. And Dr. Tarnow is a psychiatrist who was this guy, a psychiatrist working with Ron, who's a psychologist. Robert Turner's an epileptologist, child neurologist,
Rusty.
and Rusty, yep, and well knowledgeable in all of the neuromodulatory techniques. Emma and Aaron and Anne were students under Ron, and I think that they've all got like their doctorate or degree, master's or doctorate degree at this point. And Nash is an old friend I've known since the 70s, and he's a world famous electroencephalographer. So this group basically is looking at epileptiform activity as seen in kids. What's the prevalence in various disorders, and what's the implication for treatment? And when you actually go through the data, the incidence of epileptiform content in ADD, ADHD, 25, 30%.
This, Jay, what caught my eye was Tourette's, because we haven't really talked about it. And when I hear Tourette's, the less knowledgeable one of the two here by far, I just hear swearing. What is going on with Tourette's? What is
Well,
Tourette's?
Tourette's is a di first of all, Tourette's is a discharge in a specific nuclear body within the brain. It's the caudate. The head of the caudate up in the front discharges there, cause a motor tick. That's just a twitchy ticky. It's not the vocalizations or echolalia. If The discharge goes to the tail of the caudate. The head of the caudate is part of the frontal motor regulatory loop, but the tail of the caudate hooks into the amygdala hippocampus area via the stria terminalis. And the discharges in the tail of the caudate are going to stimulate the amygdala, which gives you limbic speech, emotional words, terms of endearment sometimes. But those are the good ones. Most of the time, it's like swearing like a sailor.
Yeah.
Now, my brother was a sailor. He graduated out of the Naval Academy, and he knew how to swear before he went in. So I don't know where this swearing sailor thing came from, but you know, I think sailors swear just like the people in the Air Force or Army. So, you know, anyway. You don't need an example of limbic speech. We can all come up with a dozen examples very quickly and mutter them to ourselves. The echolalia is a hippocampal. The amygdala and hippocampus are really tightly intertwined, but if the impact is on the hippocampus, then what you say. Yeah, they'll echo it back. Echolalia or parroting, sometimes it's called. how annoying, you know. And so I had two sisters who would pester each other doing that talk back thing, and it came to fisticuffs a few times, you know. So but this is an involuntary discharge. These are not people who are trying to say F you to somebody deliberately, but it comes out, and it's pretty hard to deny sometimes that it's deliberate.
Or it could
deliberate.
Be, love you.
Yep, it could be. But it's a blurting, jerky expression. It's not, this isn't somebody, you know, let me tell you the ways, you know, of love or something. I mean, this is, there's no treatise here.
So is that is that what a tic is?
A motor tic is just the head of the caudate. And now there are other kinds of tics than Tourette's. You can have a excess tension held in the motor strip and over time, and then have a discharge and have a kind of a big twitch as you're starting to fall asleep. That's a different thing.
Okay.
Myoclonic twitch. And not all myoclonic twitches are myoclonic epilepsy. So, but Tourette's is not treated universally with an anticonvulsant because it doesn't help. If you give it to the symptom of Tourette's, it doesn't necessarily help all of the people who have Tourette's. So it's not just a form of epilepsy. They don't get anticonvulsants. However, we look at Tourette's EEGs, and if we see a distinct spike, we give an empirical trial on an anticonvulsant, and it tends to work very nicely. We've had very good success. Sometimes when an anticonvulsant is prescribed and it stops a tic, the family gets a little concerned and want to know that it's not actually epilepsy. So there's been some concern about that. We're not trying to change the diagnosis. Tourette's is a bad enough diagnosis. We're just trying to get a match to the proper pharmacology. And the DSMs aren't real anyway, so why try to change the categorization when it's an imaginary category anyway? So.
And chicken or the egg, we'll leave it at this one, Jay. Sleep disorders. Well, if you don't get enough sleep, don't you come up with disorders? And
well, you're going to potentiate a lot of things that wouldn't necessarily be sticking a head above the horizon line to be noticed. The longer you miss sleep, the worse the regulation of the brain. And if you have a small discharge that's subclinical, entirely subclinical, nobody's ever noticed it, including you, and you miss a couple nights sleep, well, one night's sleep deprivation increases the likelihood of seeing a discharge in the EEG by 50 to 70%. You miss a few nights sleep, that little subclinical thing, maybe your first ever clinical seizure. You might be driving. You know, I mean, that it's sleep deprivation becomes more and more hazardous the further into it you get. You can't eventually keep yourself awake. And you'll start to look like a narcoleptic, you know, literally falling asleep.
With no drinking.
Well, if you're sleep deprived and drinking, you're going to be passed out pretty bad at some point, you know.
Jay, when you do the sleep tests and they send you a kit to do at home, like, what are they doing?
Well, there are different sleep studies. I had a 3-bed sleep lab where we hooked up 16 channels of data, airflow for the nose and mouth, oximetry to make sure your blood oxygen and pulse is going well. We had submental EMG, the tongue, basically the muscle tension of the tongue drops down as you fall into a REM state. You have a muscle drop. You have muscles on the leg because restless leg syndrome or periodic leg movement needs to be detected. You have a body position monitor. Are you on your side or your back or your front? Some people have apnea only when they're on their back, obstructive apnea, supine. You can get a shirt that has a big ball in the middle of the back, and you wear that at night, and you're not going to want to lay on your back. So you can avoid being an apneic on your back with a...
Or your wife or partner's elbow.
That'll work too. The ones that they sent, and we also had thoracic and abdominal strain gauges for your respiratory breathing pattern. If you have an obstruction, you can still try to breathe, but you're shunting air from the top to bottom of your lung. You'll see a reciprocal strain gauge pattern. We'll monitor eye movement, and we monitor EEG. So eye movement for REM, obviously rapid eye movement, you want to monitor eye movement, and EEG to give you what stage sleep you're in. Now, 16 channels is a lot to cram into a little box to send home. So they're probably not going to be monitoring your EEG. They'll pick up your sleep stages like Oura Rings or Fitbits do, and they're reasonably good. They're not perfect, oxygen? But they're reasonably good. They'll give an oximeter. Usually you'll have to slip on an oximeter, and they'll give something to slip under your bed to monitor for movement. I have to say first of all, I was shocked as hell when I saw an Oura Ring could do a reasonably good job monitoring sleep stages and things off your finger. I mean, we had a 3-bed sleep lab. We spent a small freaking fortune setting up sleep labs, and now you can get a damn ring, you know? Well, you know, the technology is really quite good. And the scrubbing of state out of the data flow from a ring or a watch, a Fitbit, Apple Watch. Apple Watch, I think, has lost their oximeter in an argument about patent rights and stuff. So they might be a little impaired from doing that right for the moment. But that'll get straightened out. That's just money and business. They'll figure it out. You know,
what a tangent.
What? Yeah, of course. That's how
we roll, baby.
That's my world, you know. It all spins around, and I focus on different spots at different times. So,
well, whatever's in the news, that's what we're here to do, because that's all what people will pay attention to. Unfortunately, you know, they only pay attention to the negative stuff.
Yeah. Well, at some point, the environmental thing may end up being an interesting one to do, because at Sassoon this year, we're actually doing a panel on environmental impact and body's response. And and things like that. So it's
October
important.
9th, October 9th through 13th. Jay's birthday,
yes, then.
7-5.
Yes, we plan on having a 3-day rolling birthday party with an EG meeting stuck in it, you know, and if there's a way to cram more fun into the meeting, we'll do it. Anybody who's been to one of them before, the science is good, but so are the good times. And
absolutely.
We try to have a good mix of fun and high level science. Yuri Kropotov is the high level science fellow coming in. I'm just a tech. Yuri's a multiple professor in Trondheim, Norway, and obviously was the head of the Soviet Union's neuroscience program before it broke down and was only Russia. And his laboratory is the Institute for the Human Brain in St. Petersburg, which is the premier laboratory in all of Russia. So he's a brilliant neuroscientist. He has a couple of major books that are technical in detail. So if you want to brush up on what he's up to, catch his books. And but he'll be there doing a couple major talks, and we've got a lot of major issues being discussed from the podium. And
our buddy Giancarlo,
we're going to be also challenging how we're analyzing things and how we're looking at things. And EEG Lab has given tools to people that they can use, but sometimes they don't even know how to describe what they're doing, you know. So if your patient asks what's this and you can't answer it, you should probably attend one of these things to figure out the detail of what's really going on. So anyway, we'll have fun doing the good science, and it's a small town. Large groups invade dining halls and sit in large groups for dinners, and it's kind of a rolling, ongoing meeting that goes for days. So
it's a networking conversation.
We have fun. So I'll possibly see some of you October 9th to 13th. We also live stream it. Yeah, because we know not everybody can make it to Sassoon City, just outside the immediate San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah.
So.
All right, Jay. Another great episode of the NeuroNoodle Network podcast.
Thanks for your interesting startups. And
no, thanks for your exhale.
We'll go sideways somehow, no matter what happens, you know.
Jay, have a great weekend, buddy.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hi to Renita. Bye-bye.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.